You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
From Shakespeare to Schwartz, from Fosse to Alvin Ailey, from Sondheim to Bareilles, from McNally to Fay, it happened to the greats, it still happens every day. When lightning strikes, it's the moment you know. When lightning strikes, where you're meant to go. You can stand and shout Eureka, do whatever you like. You'll never forget the moment when lightning strikes.
Hi, this is Gerald Brunner, and you're listening to When Lightning Strikes, where we talk about the heart-thumping, tingly mic drop moment that led you to becoming an artist. And to borrow from New York Times critic Stephen Holden, Christine Ebersole contains multitudes. In over three decades, this two-time Tony-winning actress has dazzled on stage and screen, in television series, concert appearances, recordings, and on and on and on and on. Her eclectic career includes everything from joining the cast of Saturday Night Live to being in the films The Wolf of Wall Street, Amadeus, and Tootsie, to starring on Broadway, playing Dorothy Brock in 42nd Street, to the dual role of Little Edie Beale and Edith Bouvier Veal in Grey Gardens, to play Elizabeth Arden in War Paint. And that's just a very small sampling of her Broadway credits. Christine is currently starring as Bob's mom, Dottie, in the CBS hit comedy, Bob Hearts Abishola. And I just want to say one more thing. New York theater critic Ben Brantley said, watching her, one feels as though they are taking a masterclass from Sir Laurence Olivier. And from her performance in Grey Gardens, Brantley also wrote, Christine Ebersole embodies a once living figure of, shall we say, distinctive style with a radiant conviction and finesse that turn surface mimicry into fine-grained portraiture. Welcome, Christine. How are you?
Wow. I'm good. That's quite an introduction.
I've been geeking out on you since 42nd Street. I mean, I remember, you know, they say you remember very specific performances in your Grey Gardens and War Paint and on and on and on. And, you know, I'll see a piece of theater, or when we were going to theater, I'll see a piece because of the artist, you know, or the director. And I always think, oh, I want to see a Christine Ebersole piece. So, mm-hmm. It's really a delight to have you. So can we talk about your lightning strikes moment when you knew you had to be an artist? Like, when, I know you grew up in Illinois.
Yeah. Right? Well, I think my father decided for me. He said, he claimed from the first day he laid eyes on me in the hospital that I was going to grow up to be a great dramatic actress. So as I say, no pressure, you know,
no but, pressure.
That was his idea, you know, but I don't know. I think it was when, there's no real one defining moment, but I know I had a teacher at the American Academy. I'm sorry, at McMurray College in Jacksonville, Illinois, that said, don't stay here. You have to go to New York.
Really?
Yeah. He told me to leave school and go to New York.
Well, let's just talk about one of the first times you were on stage. Do you remember, you know, when you were a kid and on stage?
Well, there was I guess there was another defining moment, sort of. I mean, all roads were leading to it, I think, but it doesn't really occur to you in the moment. But I grew up playing the violin, and I played violin from the time I was 8 years old until I was 15, and I was at 15 I was in the orchestra playing for the school production of Finian's Rainbow, And there was a defining moment there because I was so taken with what was happening up on the stage that I played the violin when there was no music playing. I was, you know, during a non-musical moment on the stage. And much to the chagrin of the conductor who gave me, like, you know, the evil eye. But it was that I knew then that I didn't want to be in the orchestra pit. I wanted to be up on stage doing what Betsy Miller was doing. Who was playing the star, who was the star role, you know, in Rainbow. So the following year that I was auditioned for Guys and Dolls, the production that the high school was doing at the time. And I auditioned for Sarah, the part of Sarah. And I lost the part to Linda Nissenoff because I was too tall. So Linda Nissenoff got the part, but I was in the chorus. I sang tenor in the chorus. I was a mission doll. So, I mean, that was, you know, those little things of that's how it all began. But it began before that because, you know, growing up, I remember I would take things to the hilt. Like, I remember this very distinctly, but I was about 5 years old. And crazy. I sat in a chair in the kitchen and I sat up there the entire day. And if I had to go to the bathroom, I would just crawl on my arms, you know, and because my legs weren't working. And so I would crawl my way up to the bathroom or whatever it was, get myself up on the seat and, you know, do my thing. But I just remember like my mother being very like tolerant, you know, she just was. She would just kind of do her whatever work she had to do in the kitchen. She would kind of just work around me. You know? So, but I mean, and I remember like in third grade, I thought that I wanted to be a pioneer because we were studying pioneers in third grade. Oh. So I wanted to be a pioneer. So I slept. My parents let me do it. It's so crazy. But I slept out on a sled. In this kind of room that was kind of cold, you know, but I remember like sleeping on the sled because that's what I'm sure I imagine that's what the pioneers did, you know, wasn't real, didn't have like cozy, cushy mattresses, you know what I mean? They slept on hay or something. So I just like slept on the sled and I remember like writing a letter to somebody because in those days you'd write letters. And I remember like, you know, in Illinois where I grew up, it was so freezing cold. I mean, it was just, the winters were absolutely unbearable. So I remember like taking out this like wool scarf that was like it was big at the time because I was not full grown, but it was like this big shawl. And that was my winter coat that I would use to like go outside. I'm just, you know, so I think it was obviously in the blood. And my parents didn't go, "What the heck are you doing?" You know, they just were like, "All right, you're a pioneer. Great. All right. How's it going for you?" You know, sleeping on a sled.
Well, this is like you were like a one woman Strasbourg kind of sense memory. Strasbourg studio, like you had your own actor studio. That you had those tools that you knew how to train yourself.
But I wasn't I never occurred to me that I was going to be an actor. I just wanted to embody those things. Oh, yeah. And then the other one was the Von Trapp family because they did Sound of Music, they had a movie out called The Von Trapp Family Singers. And oh my gosh, it was at the Holiday Theater. And of course, it was like a quarter in my day to go to the Holiday Theater. And I just would watch that movie over and over again. And then I would get it. My dad had been traveling. So he had brought knapsacks back from Switzerland or wherever he was traveling. So I would put these backpacks on my back. And runs around the back fields behind the house. I love to go a wandering. And be one of the Trapp family singers, you know? That was before before the actual musical. But when I was a child, I wanted to be a nurse, actually. I was going to be a nurse. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a nurse.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
So how did you end up in drama school?
When I was in college, the wheels started turning, I think. But then when I was in college, I remember speaking on the phone with my mother, where it became time to declare a major. And I thought, maybe I'll just go into social work, or maybe I'll be a social worker, or maybe I'll, be a lawyer or something like that and do something like that. And my mother said, no, get into music, get into acting. I mean, so both of my parents were like, I don't know, maybe they sensed it or saw it or something. There is actually, I actually have a recording of that my father, he had this fascination with reel-to-reel. Of course, in those days, it was reel-to-reel tape recorders.
Yeah.
And he had this fascination with recording, and he would, do these recordings of, the family during special occasions. And I remember this one that he transferred to tape, cassette tape at the time. It was Christmas Eve of 1956, and you can hear it on the recording. My father's like sounding like Edward R. Murrow. It's like, it's Christmas Eve 1956, and mother is at the piano playing Christmas carols, and the kids are singing, and Pop is about to join them. And so my mother's at the piano, and I've got three brothers. There's four children altogether. And I was the youngest of four, and my mother's playing the piano, and the kids are all singing, and they're singing Jingle Bells. We're all singing Jingle Bells. And my mother says, now let Christy sing the chorus. Now just Christy. You ready, Christy? And so my brother goes, sing! And my mother's playing Jingle Bells, and I sing. I'm 3 years old, and I'm singing Jingle Bells completely on pitch. So that was an indicator,
crazy.
That was a gift from God. So maybe they saw that. I don't know. And I think it was also trying, living vicariously through my father, because he was very, he was a very dramatic, larger than life kind of a character. And I think he was a frustrated actor, but, had a family to support and everything and was, made money as an engineer. He became an engineer. That's how my parents met in college after the war. And my mother was the rehearsal pianist at the Methodist Church. She grew up on a farm in Pennsylvania, and she was she played piano, and she was the rehearsal pianist at the Methodist Church. And so she taught all of the children how to sing harmony through the Methodist hymnal. So we'd all gather around the piano, and she would teach us all harmony at a very young age. And then we all had to take instruments, that was just required in the family. Everybody had to play an instrument. That's what you just did back in those days. And so I actually wanted to play the flute, but they had enough flute players. So I had to go to my second choice, which was the violin. So that's how I ended up playing the violin, in third grade, and then I also played the piano too, because we were, we all in the family, we all were required to play an instrument.
So that was in your genes. But then I love how your parents encouraged that piece of you. Not only they nurtured that.
In a sense, sensible job. I'm like, no, get into music, get into theater.
You know? And I love that your teacher, that you had all these wonderful people who are nurturing you along the way, like the teacher who said, go to New York.
They were just guiding me. Yeah, you can't stay here. You got to go to New York.
So do you remember when you first got to New York, what your impression was and what your take was of the big city?
Well, you know, that was another thing, because I had a girlfriend of mine who was down visiting me at McMurray College, a friend of mine who had left the school, sent me out of the blue a brochure for the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And so it was just kind of sitting on my desk in my dorm room. And my girlfriend who was visiting me, saw the brochure there. And she said, you got to fill this out. I'm not letting you leave this room till you fill this out. I mean, so it's like everybody was like hiring me, but like, what's the word? Like ushering me along the way.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even something that I was like, I've got to do this in my life. You know, it was like, okay, all right, sure, we'll do that. And then I auditioned regionally for the American Academy, and the regional person who was, you know, vetting people to audition for the Academy said, I'm going to send in my highest recommendation. So I got accepted to the American Academy, and I went to New York when I was 20 years old, and I stayed at this place called the East End Hotel for Women. And it was kind of like the Barbizon, you know, back in the
day.
And it was $46 a week, which included two meals a day. Oof. And it was kind of like a kind of a halfway house for Happy Dale. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was going on at the same time. You know? So it was like, for anybody that's observant, and I guess I could say that about myself, that, observing is part of a big part of what it takes to be an actor, you know, because you're observing somebody's behavior, and you're sort of like bringing it into yourself and kind of then, you know, giving your interpretation of it. So, but there was this, it was like women were on one floor and men were on another floor. And so I shared a room with my college roommate who had graduated. She was 2 years older than me. And so she had graduated from McMurray College, and she was coming back to New York. So we shared this room together, and there was a sink in the room, and there was like a bathroom down the hall. And there was this woman. Oh my God, she was so great. She was such a great character. You know, she was like, she just was. She lived down the hall. God knows what her story was, but you know, she goes, I spoke to Mayor Lindsay the other day, and you know, she's like, you know, she's all of a sudden like really good friends with the mayor, you know, he's giving her the scoop on what's going on, and she would have her shoes like very, very easily lined up. And, you know, it just, you knew that she wasn't, you know, all there, but I mean, but at the same time, you weren't frightened by her. She just was like, wow, this is like an amazing character. You know, I could add it to the roster of pioneer women and, you know,
all these eclectic characters gathered.
For a couple of months while I went to the American Academy.
And then ultimately you got, was it very soon after that you got Angel Street? Was that your first Broadway?
I had gotten an agent which was very unusual at the time at the American Academy, because I was doing a play in my second year, and you had to be asked back to your second year. And I got a scholarship, which was really nice, the second year. But I was doing a play called The Robesart Affair, which was about the young Queen Elizabeth I. So it was like the 1500s, whatever. And so there was written by this guy named Francis Letton, who was a teacher at the school, and he was the playwright. And so he was represented by this woman named Lucy Kroll. So she came to see the play, and she was taken by my performance and wanted to represent me. So this was very unusual, you know what I mean? Because she had her clients were like, you know, Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis and all that kind of stuff. And so she wanted to take me on. So she introduced me after I graduated in 1975, and I was working as a waitress at the Lion's Rock, which was on 77th between 1st and 2nd. And I lied my way into that job too, because I've never waited tables in my life. But I And so I, you know, the guy, there was this German, oh my God, he was so great. This German manager who always had this real tough exterior, you know. It's like, you know, he wouldn't suffer fools. But at the same time, you know, he's like, oh, where did you work before? I said, well, yeah, I worked at this place called the Steak and Brew in Chicago. Like, okay, you know, so he hired me. And of course, I didn't know what I was doing at all. And thankfully, the girls, you know, the waitresses that were there were very, very helpful to help me. But anyway, so I was back from working a shift. And previously, Lucy Kroll had introduced me to this producer named Shepard Traub, who was producing this play called Angel Street on Broadway at the Lyceum Theater with Dina Merrill and Michael Allison. Ah. And Christine Andreas was playing the part that it was based. The Angel Street was the play, and the movie was Gaslight with Ingrid Bergman.
Oh, that was Gaslight. Gaslight.
Yeah, that came from the play Angel Street. Angel Street came first.
Oh,
and
so okay.
And that was Angela Lansbury's first film role.
Yes.
And so
yes.
19 years old, she played the Cockney maid, Nancy.
Yes, so Paula.
She introduced me to Shepard Traub. Now that the part was already cast, it was already, you know, sewn up. So, but then what happened was, after I met him, and then I was home, you know, from working a shift at the Lions Rock. That's when my agent called me and she said, "Darling, you're on Broadway." I was like, "What?" She's like, "You know that I had gotten." What happened was Christine Andreas went to do My Fair Lady with Rex Harrison, so she had to leave the show. So they needed a replacement. So I was the replacement. So that was a very humbling experience because, you know, it was like, well, I go back to work. It's like, well, you know, I got to leave you little people because the big great white way is calling. And so, you know, they had to buy my equity card and everything. And I was waiting tables and then on Broadway. And then the show closed after 3 weeks. So I was back begging, you know, for the manager for my job back. Give it back to me.
And then it wasn't, we won't go through your whole, but then the next one was on the 20th Century, right? It was like a few years later.
Well, it was a few years later, but in the meantime, I had I had gone to South Carolina to the South Carolina Arts Commission and did a new musical that my friend Mel Marvin had written with Robert Montgomery called Green Pond. And it was based on a place in South Carolina. And so it was four characters. And we went down to South Carolina and toured the state of South Carolina in a station wagon. We would drive from place to place and then put on this play, which was very, very controversial at the time because these four characters were, two of them were living together, not married, and lived together. And there were people that had not ever seen a musical, a play, nothing. I mean, it was, you know, we did it in church basements and places like that. I mean, it was very rudimentary, but it was an amazing experience, amazing experience.
But that set you on the course of.
And then we came in to do it off Broadway at the West Side Arts Theater.
Oh, okay.
And that's when Clive Barnes, I remember so, you know, I so distinctly that, you know, it was the way it was set up at the West Side Arts Theater. There were like little cabaret tables. I don't know. And this,
yes,
it was called the Chelsea West Side at the time. And I remember Clive Barnes was sitting, you know, in a front row seat. And he was, you know, we identified him. And he fell asleep. He fell asleep through most of the show and gave us a good review. So I was very happy about that. I guess his dreams were compatible somehow with the show. But, you know, all these little lessons about, like, you know, you can't take reviews, to heart.
Right.
Because the good ones either. Because, you know, because as soon as you get a good review, you'll be thrown off your high horse and thrown under the bus in the next one. And that's happened to me. So it's like,
I hear you. I understand. Is this too woo-woo? Is it hard to describe how performing makes you feel?
When you were giving the accolades at the kind of, I was like, wow, you know, but it kind of made me, and I'm going to probably start to cry because it's so heartbreaking what's happening, you know, around the world and with these theaters being closed and everything. And, you know, as much as, you love, you know, you appreciate film. I'm going to speak for myself. As much as I appreciate film and television and all that kind of stuff, there's no fulfillment or power and fulfillment and as close to a spiritual experience of a community with God that you get on the live stage, in front of a live audience, people shoulder to shoulder, packed in there, and the audience is another invited character, and it's that sense of fellowship and that sense of community. And that sense of how a play or a musical can give you a transcend. You can transcend the sorrows of the world in a way.
That's beautiful.
And that's been taken from us.
Yes.
And now it's not, it's really like, you know, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. And that's the situation we're in right now. And that's the truth. Humpty Dumpty is not going to be put back together again. You're not going to sit there with 1,000 eggshells and go, oh, I got an eggshell over here. Let me see what it matches. It's not going to happen. So the only way that the theater is going to come back is to restore it to what happened before all this stuff happened. You can't have social distancing and, you know, masks and all of that other stuff going on and call it live theater. Can't do it. You know, I mean, I know that a friend of mine who's a producer was asked to put a plastic shield in front of the stage.
Oh, gosh.
To put a plastic shield no, then you don't call it theater.
Yes.
Call it the freaking Twilight Zone, because that's what it is. It's not theater. And so, you know, and that's why I'm having this emotional response, because you know, it's theater is theater and opera and, you know, clubs and nightclubs and, you know, those social gatherings when people are shoulder to shoulder and, you know, cheering, you know, one another on or, you know, or gasping or whatever the collected response is from an audience. That is what is live theater, and that is what is healing, and that is what is transcending. And to put in rubber dolls in between the seats, don't call it theater. That's not what it is. So, you know, so my heart is broken because of that. I know that, there's a way just like in the cement, the truth of nature and the truth of God's creation, you know, at that time when you see the little tree that's poking up through the cement, the cracks in the cement.
Yes.
And that's really what we have to look to and to hope for, is that there's some place, whatever it is, if it's in somebody's backyard or somebody's You know, somebody builds a barn, you know, in a field somewhere that's not encumbered by the rules and regulations of the cities and the world in that sense, that there's going to be a revival, but it's not going to come through trying to put back Humpty Dumpty. It's not going to work. It's not, you know.
It's going to be a new
It's going to be the little palm tree that's coming through the cracks of the cement. That's what it's going to be. And so there's hope in that, but it's not going to come through putting Humpty Dumpty back together. It's all the king's horses and all the king's men aren't going to do it.
So, I hear you, but I'm full. I'm an optimist. That
oh no, that's the completely
cracks,
optimistic.
The cracks. Yes, yes. And I agree with you.
The optimism is the palm tree coming through the cracks of the cement. Absolutely.
Yes, that it will happen. It will come back. And in the meantime, I mean, you're on this wonderful series.
Yes.
You want to talk about Bob Hart's Abishola? Abishola. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love the series so much, and your character Dottie, Bob's mom, is just delicious and complicated and tells it like it is and kind of fearless.
I got hired by Chuck Lorre and he sat me down and said, listen, you know, in the fourth, fifth episode, you know, we're going to have a big shift. And I'm thinking, okay, that's it. He heard me sing. So he's going to make me, I know what's going to happen. We'll talk about it, tomorrow. So I had a day to think about it and I'm thinking, okay, I got it. You know, he had me sing, you know, a cappella on the first episode. It was great, you know. So I know what's going to happen. It's going to shift and it's going to be like Dottie centric. I said, I know. They're in Detroit. She's going to be like a nightclub singer. And I'm going to I can see myself with the gowns and the nice false eyelashes and the soft lighting and everything at the mic. It's going to be great. And I'm going to, oh my God, this is going to be so great. I'm going to be a nightclub singer. This is going to be so cool to be on this series. And I'm like, so the next day he comes back and he goes, she's going to have a stroke. I was like, what?
Oh boy.
Okay.
So you didn't know.
No.
So when you took on the role, you didn't know that she was going to have.
No.
Okay. No.
Oh, heavens no.
So what do you like about her? What qualities do you like about her? She's a tough cookie.
Yeah. I mean, you know, oftentimes I'll say, who had such a terrible mother to write me like this, you know? She's a terrible mother.
Yes.
But here we are in Hollywood. You know, I would just say I absolutely love the cast. It's like the greatest cast of people that I could ever ask for or hope for. And I adore everyone. So I'm very blessed to be a part of this wonderful, wonderful group of, you know, people and the producers and everyone is just top drawer, as my mother would say.
And we haven't seen a lot of characters like this portrayed on network television. Do you mind sharing what the premise is? Or I could say, but you can probably explain it better, that there's Bob and his siblings, and you're the mother,
and
you make compression socks.
And my husband passed away, and so he has a heart attack and goes to the hospital, and he got 5 stents put in, and he wakes up, and there's this beautiful Nigerian nurse named Abishola, and so they fall in love and, you know, the rest is history. So it's kind of like this collision of cultures, you know?
Yes. Yes. And and it looks like, you know, maybe they will end up together. We don't know. It's been picked up for a second season.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know when you'll be shooting again or are, is
we
there,
start
can you
this
say?
Week. We start this week, which is really exciting.
No, I imagine you can't say what is going to happen, but and here you've had some romance.
Yeah, that's why we have to tune in.
Yeah.
I don't know when it's going to start back, though. I'm really excited for when the actual air date is. I'm sure they have to get, you know, these episodes under the belt, you know.
Exactly. And you get to sing. You get to sing a little bit.
Yeah, they do get
delightful.
Me to sing. which is so nice, you know, which is very sweet. You know, Chuck is very generous that way.
And what is it like for you? Because you play someone with a stroke so convincingly.
I don't know if you ever saw it online. People are like, did Christine really have a stroke?
And I saw that. I saw that when I was...
Well, that's acting.
That's acting. But when you have a part like this, or, you know, like, you know, or an EDB, how do you mind taking me through your process, how that all works? I mean, I'm sure every character is different.
It goes back, sleeping on the sled. It's just sort of imagining what it's like.
Yeah. So you...
And yeah. I think it just comes from, you know, the visual of like seeing people that have had strokes, or, you know, just seeing what the physical manifestations are. And then you imagine what those physical manifestations are.
I see. What would you, I know we have to tune in, but would you like for her to fall in love? Daddy?
Of course.
Yes.
Of course. Everybody wants to be loved.
I know.
Everybody wants love.
I know. And I love that she loves Abishola, that they've bonded. And she's
the daughter
really...
I never had, even though I have a daughter.
And I also love, I know you said you got hired, but I love how eclectic the breadth of roles you play. When I think about that, you're the same person who played, you know, Elizabeth Arden in War Paint, and then Edie Beale.
And Leo DiCaprio's mother in Wall Street.
Exactly. But is there a role you're aching to play? Is there a role that you think, oh God, I've got to tackle that? Or it's yet to be written?
I think you know, there's a lot of parts that, I mean, I would have loved to have done Gypsy, but I'm too old now. But, totally. I couldn't have a 7-year-old and, like, you know, I mean, I do believe in miracles, but I mean, come on, you know, so,
how old was that filmer? Anyway.
But, and I, you know, Sweeney Todd is another one that I really love.
Oh yeah.
I think you could probably be any age to do that, but
you're Mrs. Lovett.
Yeah, Mrs. Yeah. Lovett. I mean, just the challenge musically, you know, I think is really exciting. I think the ones that haven't been written, you know, but I don't know. It's just like, I don't kind of think in those terms. You know what I mean? I don't think like, oh my gosh, I'm dying to do this. I just, it's kind of like the phone rings, somebody goes, oh wow, I've got this for you. Oh, that looks amazing. Yeah, let me check it out, you know? So it's that kind of a I'm at that stage in my life.
Yeah.
I'm at that stage in my life. I think when I was younger, you know, it was all, I've got to play this role. Now it's like, you know, that would be nice. Sure. Why not?
Why not? Yeah. Is there something you wish you could tell that kid who was sleeping outside as a pioneer woman? Or that,
yeah,
or,
take you it know, easy.
Or, you know, the kid or who first moved to that Barbizon-esque hotel, was it called, and in New York, you know, was just and was trying to get the waitressing job. Is there something you wish you could tell that Christine?
Well, I think that's just kind of life, isn't it? It's like things that you hold up as so important aren't as important when you get older and you've lived through it, you know? Your priorities change. But no, there's nothing I would take back or change, because that's it's the learning curve, you know?
Yeah, and do these roles, you know, do you sort of take them with you on your journey. You know, take the Edies and the Elizabeths and do you take them?
Well, they're
with
just
you, the
Dottie's they just be, and, they're just kind of part of you because they emerged from you. You know, they emerged from a part of me.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
So it's something that to draw on in terms of, the strength of their character, the fortitude of their character. You know, I think that just kind of speaks to life.
Yes.
You have to have fortitude because it's a jungle out there.
It is. It is, but I also love. Like, I think about how you've played so many different in so many different genres as well. You know, and I think about Dinner at Eight and all the different current role, present day. I love that one.
Oh my god, that was such.
I love that one.
That was. Oh, I just really cherish that one.
Yeah, that was really, I mean, as an audience member, it was so special. But, and how are you staying nourished during this time of this very surreal time? How do you stay sane and together? And
I'm very grateful that my daughter is here with me.
That's great.
So, so I'm not alone. I don't envy those that are alone.
Yeah.
So it's just, how do we find fellowship and community with family, like-mindedness, like-minded people. So that's my husband, we've had a lot of time that we've been able to be together. So that's because we have a home on the East Coast, and I have this apartment on the West Coast because of working out here. But we've literally lived in New Jersey for 21 years.
In Maplewood, right? The other wood.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you've had a family. And that's also what's so wonderful is that you're a mom with several children. And
three children and children. Seven pets. So it's Bill's been nicknamed Uncle Zookeeper. So, and my son Elijah just graduated from the American Academy of Dramatic Arts with a scholarship both years. So I'm thrilled for him. And this is a very unique time to be starting out.
That's fantastic. What was that like for you when he said he wants to be an actor? Is that when he studied performing arts?
Yeah,
that's right. I think. What was that like when he decided to choose that path? What was that like for you? See him.
Well, I mean, he's definitely has the talent, the God-given talent. And so I think it's the question one must ask of oneself is, the talent is a given, the commitment, that's what you have to really take stock of is your commitment.
Yes.
I mean, but that's the way it is in life, isn't it?
That's right. To anything, if you want to succeed. Yeah. What is it?
So he really proved that his commitment when he went to the academy.
That's fantastic. And he graduated. Now he's out. And do you give him advice? What kind of advice do you give him?
Well, it's really just kind of about, fortitude and commitment and perseverance.
Yeah. And being willing to be, sleepy outside. I keep thinking of your rosebud. That was your rosebud.
It was my magic flyer or whatever it was. Nice being able to recall these things,
Yes.
It just makes a life,
Exactly.
Look back on it because, because the future is uncertain, but it does become more certain in how we view it and how we manage it. That's really kind of the hope is just to keep remembering the palm tree that has come through the cracks of the cement. And that's the truth.
Yes.
The truth is the palm tree. That's the truth.
Yes.
The little palm tree that comes through the cracks of the cement.
Yes.
And or wherever you are in the world, if it's a pine tree, yes, an oak tree, or a mighty oak, yes, that comes from that little acorn that,
yes,
pokes, that where it says, you know, you can't grow here. And that's, they're saying, no, that what you said, you can't grow here, is a lie. And I'm showing you right now that I am the truth, because I am coming through the cracks.
Yes.
So that's really the test is how we see it. As creative artists who are given gifts, that's what we focus on.
Yeah. Do you think it can be learned? Do you think people can learn it, or do you think it has to be innate? Your gift.
Well, you have to be you learn to be a good steward of your gift. That's where all the lessons, the violin lessons, come in.
Amen. There you go. So even
yes, yeah, we have to learn about how to be a good steward of our gift.
Yes.
So that's why we take classes and we learn, you know, how to, yes, speak accents and how to get to make sure we get to places on time and, you know, wear the appropriate clothing and have the appropriate haircuts and have the appropriate whatever.
Yes.
The manners and the demeanor and the goodwill that we bring wherever, yes, we go. So those are things that we learn, but the gift is given.
Yes, which you have. Well, thank you
so much. Everybody gets
one. We all get one?
Everybody's been given a gift. Everybody in the world. Isn't that amazing?
That's amazing. I love that.
Yeah, so everybody. It's like when the gift of the magi, you know, when they all
come to
the manger and they got the gold and the frankincense, yes, and myrrh. Everybody, yes, got the gold and frankincense and myrrh. Everybody got it, but it just comes in these different, you know, forms.
So the question is,
I was given the gift of singing.
But how do you know your gift? Sometimes that's the question, is what if you don't know it? It's just a rhetorical question.
Well,
you gotta figure it out.
Then what you do is you just tune in to yourself, tune in to what, you know, what excites you.
Yes. We all have the gift. Oh,
we all got one.
We all got the gift. Oh, yeah. Well, it's a gift to talk to you. And
yes,
thank
it's a
you.
Gift to talk to you too.
Thank you so much.
It happens every day when lightning strikes. It's the moment you know.
The theme song was written by Tom McGovern. This episode was edited by Kyle Moore, and the talent was booked by Anna Strauss.
When lightning strikes.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah,
not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.